In the coming week, President Donald Trump delivers the State of the Union address. A U.S.-Russian nuclear arms treaty is in trouble, and the U.S. case against a Chinese telecom giant heats up. It's January 31st, 2019, and time for The World Next Week. I'm Bob McMahon.
And I'm Jim Lindsay.
Well, Jim, it took a little extra time, but it looks like we will have a State of the Union address in the coming week. There was a contretemps between the Speaker of the House, Nancy Pelosi, and President Donald J. Trump. But now, this coming Tuesday, February 5th, there will be a State of the Union address. Could you talk a little bit, Jim, about how we should view this address, which is going to be probably more anticipated than many in recent years?
Bob, I would suspect that President Trump is going to try to use the State of the Union to reset the political agenda. As you noted, the State of the Union address was originally scheduled for late January. It was postponed because of the government shutdown. Speaker of the House, Nancy Pelosi, declined to issue the formal invitation required for the president to speak in the well of the House. The shutdown has been lifted at least for a couple of weeks, depending on whether a deal can be worked out. But politically, the shutdown was a loser for the president. We can see that in all the public opinion polls. So now having the State of the Union address is a chance for the president to sort of redefine the political agenda. I would imagine that he is going to place the wall in the center of the speech. I would also imagine he's going to do what most presidents do, use the State of the Union as an opportunity to check off all of the successes they believe they have had in office. And I think one of the interesting things for people in our business looking at foreign policy is going to be looking at which foreign policy issues he talks about, what he says about those issues, and just as important, which foreign policy issues don't merit a mention in the State of the Union.
Yeah, on that point, Jim, you know, this is an unconventional presidency, as has been noted many times. And the president has a certain way of expanding on some of his achievements, let's say, but also signaling things he may do. I think it makes it particularly difficult to kind of get a sense of what really his priorities may be. Although it's also true that President Trump, as candidate Trump, laid out his views on a number of issues and he's followed through on that pretty consistently. However, in a speech like this, how should we be kind of listening in terms of, is it the volume of times he refers to, say, the wall and related issues? Is it the number of times he mentions foreign policy? Or is it really about maybe the tenor of it?
Well, you're going to see all of that, Bob. And I would suspect that when you pick up the newspaper or log on to the internet the day after the speech, you'll see a number of graphics showing bubbles of which words got used, and people will be going through it. And I would sort of say, look for a couple of things. One, is there anything new here? Does the president mention any new initiatives, whether about the wall, immigration policy, or other issues? Again, remember, this is a president who campaigned on the idea of rebuilding America's infrastructure. The whole issue of infrastructure has been lost for the last 2 years. Do we see, for example, the revival of infrastructure, some effort on that score? Second thing is, I think, as you mentioned, look for tenor, tone. Does the president strike, let's say, the dark notes of his inaugural address? We talked about an American carnage. Keep in mind, the president has been tweeting in the last day or so about three caravans of immigrants that are now forming in Central America heading north. Do we get that kind of speech? Or do we get a speech in which the president tries to do what many of his supporters and his critics have long hoped that he would do, try to build bridges and unite the country? And again, I think the third thing is always going to be, what doesn't he talk about? And I think that space is going to be filled in, at least to some extent, by the Democratic response. And I will note, the Democrats are going to do something different with their response to the State of the Union. They're going to have someone who doesn't hold political office give the response. That person is Stacey Abrams. She ran a very tight but ultimately unsuccessful race last fall for the governorship of Georgia. So I can expect her to sort of try to talk about what Democratic priorities are or might be. And I'll also note that if you want to listen to the Democratic response in Spanish, it will be given by California's new Attorney General Xavier Becerra, who will talk about a riff on the president's speech.
These speeches, as you say, are it's a bit of political theater. It's a bit of laying out markers. It's happening. It's the first time Trump is going to face a Congress that is divided between the two major powers. So Republican control of the House and Senate in his previous appearance. This time you have the House, obviously, in the hands of the Democrats. Standing behind him will be Nancy Pelosi next to Vice President
Pence. And there will be a lot of commentary about the speaker's body language as the president speaks. That's virtually guaranteed.
And it's, again, I mentioned he was an unconventional president in it, but this is, as you say, a moment for possible bridge building. He had signaled shortly after this past election day a desire to work with who he refers to as Chuck and Nancy on being Chuck Schumer in the Senate, Nancy Pelosi, on issues like, let's say, infrastructure. So that could be an area where they try to find, or at least he tries to indicate common cause. The wall seems like it's going to loom largely over everything else, however, and the latest talks don't show any sense of any resolution in the near future.
Yeah, I think that's the case. And again, on foreign policy, Bob, I'd be looking to see what does the president say about North Korea. As you know, we're headed to a second summit with North Korean President Kim, and this is coming against the backdrop this week of the U.S. intelligence chiefs testifying on the Hill and saying that, in their view, the North Koreans have no intention of giving up their nuclear weapons, a position that the president has taken sharp issue with on Twitter. But you also have the issue of what's the president going to say about Venezuela, likely also what is the president going to say, if anything, about Iran. I'll note that, again, on Twitter, the president tweeted out that, in his view, U.S. intelligence, let me quote him here, seems to be extremely passive and naive when it comes to Iran, end quote. Another question here is, are we going to see the president make any news on China? We're looking at a March 3rd deadline for this ongoing set of negotiations with China over trade, and there's some talk that perhaps we may see unveiled a potential meeting sometime in February, President Trump with President Xi.
Yeah, I think trade is going to be one of the more intriguing topics that he deals with both in the speech and going forward in terms of how the Democrats respond. And you're not necessarily seeing a strong globalist strain emerge from the new Democrats who've come in since the midterms. And Democrats like, well, Democratic candidate Bernie Sanders, but also other Democrats have not been big fans of agreements like NAFTA. The House is going to have to vote on the NAFTA 2.0 deal coming up, for example. But there's also, you know, there was TPP had aroused a lot of concern in the Democratic Party. So Trump may be saying some things that don't necessarily go against the grain with many Democrats on trade.
That may be true of sort of the mood on some parts of the Democratic caucus on Capitol Hill. I will note that if you look at public opinion polls, trade and NAFTA are much more popular than you might gather from listening to Sherrod Brown or Elizabeth Warren. But Bob, let's switch gears and talk about another big issue coming up, and that is the fate of the Intermediate Nuclear Forces Treaty. Come next week, President Trump will decide whether to officially withdraw the United States from the INF Treaty. The president announced back in October that he intended to do so, in part because of what he said was Russian refusal to comply with the terms of the treaty, but also concerns about Chinese intermediate-range ballistic missiles. I expect the president's going to follow through on that threat, Bob. Why, though?
First of all, I'll provide a little bit of a backdrop. As you indicated, this is a Cold War era treaty. And those of us of a certain age, meaning you and I in particular, Jim, but others, would recall a period of time in the 1980s where there was actually quite a bit of tension between the U.S. and Soviet Union over these types of missiles, the Pershing 2 from the U.S. side and the SS-20, I believe, from the Soviet side, in terms of deploying them in Europe. And people in Europe were extremely concerned about being in the arena for intermediate range nuclear forces. And then there was a breakthrough between Presidents Reagan and Soviet leader Gorbachev, and they agreed to get rid of them. And in fact, it was, I believe, it was the first treaty in which it wasn't just freezing levels, it was actually removing and dismantling these weapons and setting up.
Just to be clear here, these were ground-based
weapons. These are ground-based, right.
It didn't apply to sea-based or air-based missiles, and that itself is critical.
Exactly. But it was a step in a direction where some people took some hope that this could lead to other changes. But that aspect that you mentioned, Jim, the it was just ground-based, I think it affected the Soviets and now the follow-on successor state of Russia much more than the United States, which had an arsenal for sea and air that was much more formidable and much more flexible than Russia has currently. And so Russia developed its own missile, and this is what's concerning the U.S., that it's, I believe it's known as the Novator, NM-729. It's believed to have a range, the U.S. official state has a range that exceeds the 5,500-kilometer range in the treaty, and the Russians say, well, you really haven't offered any kind of credible proof of this, and, you know, we reject the criticism. But, you know, arms control talks are beyond just the accusation side. It's also sort of building up a sense of trust and a kind of a long-haul aspect to this. The two sides are not talking about a lot of things right now. The relations are quite corrosive at the moment. And we just heard over this past few days in a meeting that actually occurred in Beijing that involved the U.S. and Russians as well as the Chinese, that arms control officials from U.S. and Russia haven't really gotten anywhere in terms of getting traction or at least some momentum that would deter move away from this treaty. There's a lot of concern that clock goes back, and in Europe in particular, you start seeing the emergence of something we haven't seen in a generation, which is land-based mid-range nuclear missiles.
Well, this is significant for a couple of reasons, Paul. Let me tick off three. One is that if the United States initiates withdrawal from the treaty, then the problem that the United States complained about is likely to get worse. That is, Russian production of intermediate range missiles. Again, if the treaty goes away, the Russians are free to do what they want, which is why a lot of arms control experts would say the Trump administration is giving the Russians what they want in the sense that they get to build these weapons and they can blame the United States for being the one that broke the treaty. Second, it's not clear how leaving the treaty advantages the United States. Again, because the treaty does not apply to air-based and sea-based missiles in this range, the United States can provide target coverage with other weapons, again, air and sea-based intermediate range missiles. And the United States right now doesn't have an intermediate range ground-based missile in development, so it's going to take a while to be able to do that. And when it does, it's not at all clear where the United States is going to be able to deploy such weapons. Again, if you go back to the original INF debate, it caused major political concerns in Europe. And it's not clear that any European countries right now, outside of perhaps Poland, is looking forward to providing bases for U.S. ground-based missiles. Same as even more so when we look at American allies in Northeast Asia. And that gets to the third issue, which is that this debate, while it's framed as the United States and Russia, clearly affects the national interests of a lot of other countries. And the Europeans are greatly concerned that with the disappearance of INF, if that in fact happens, that it will lead to, again, a sizable increase in Russian intermediate nuclear forces, which would threaten Europe. So there is a great deal of concern within the transatlantic alliance about the decision that President Trump looks like he's going to make to take the U.S. out of the INF treaty.
Yeah, and I think it's worth mentioning also the landscape that this is happening against. When the original treaty was negotiated, it was the epic, you know, struggle between these two nuclear superpowers, in which there was an ideology at play as well, the Soviet communism and its communist bloc, and U.S. leading the forces of freedom and so forth, and U.S. having labeled Soviet Union the evil empire. There was a concern that they were with weapons targeted at each other's capitals and so forth, that there was a great deal at stake, let's say, and a great deal of fear about a wrong step leading to an attack because of this antagonistic relationship. It seems like it's, you know, the present day, this, while there's much has been made of Russia and China emerging as new geopolitical rivals of the U.S., it just doesn't feel like there is that sense of being an existential threat. And yet, nuclear weapons obviously are the ultimate existential threat. And so it just seems like it's a really tough time to be moving away from a treaty that has seemingly worked so well for the U.S., even though China is not covered by it.
Yeah, and on that point, Bob, it's not obvious that leaving the INF treaty is going to put pressure on the Chinese to agree to limit their intermediate nuclear forces. Again, I have to go back. The size of the Chinese nuclear arsenal is much smaller than either the Russian or the U.S. nuclear arsenals. And all signs coming out of Beijing have been, if you want to leave the INF treaty, fine, but you're not going to get us to limit our much smaller nuclear forces. So it's not clear where this is all going to go as we go forward.
Well, Jim, let's keep with the topic of U.S.-China, but we'll move to another arena. Let's call it trade and security. And this is involving the U.S. case against Huawei, a Chinese telecom giant, and its CFO, Meng Wanzhou, who has been indicted by the U.S. after allegedly circumventing U.S. sanctions on Iran and stealing trade secrets from T-Mobile, among other things. The trial, there's an extradition case going on involving Canada. There's a trial that was originally set for the coming week. It's been pushed to March. But Jim, catch us up on what's going on with this case and the implications.
Well, Ms. Meng was arrested when she flew into Vancouver, Canada, by the Canadian authorities. She was arrested because the United States government had asked the Canadian government to do so. There was supposed to be an extradition hearing next week. Again, as you mentioned, that has now been postponed. But this particular case, which is focused on U.S. claims that Ms. Meng, who often goes by her English language name of Sabrina, had engaged in activities designed to allow Huawei to evade U.S. sanctions directed toward Iran. And we'll see how the extradition case is going to play out. It's clearly created significant problems for Canada in terms of its bilateral relations with the Chinese. Beijing has made it clear it's very unhappy, doesn't think that Ms. Meng should be in jail. They've arrested in what is pretty clearly a retaliatory move, two Canadian citizens living in China, and a third Canadian citizen who had been convicted of a drug smuggling violation suddenly was retried and sentenced to death. So Beijing is clearly sending signals on that score. But on the U.S. side of this, this particular issue is embedded in a much broader set of issues. One, obviously, is the whole trade dispute between the United States and China. And again, as we talked last week, senior Chinese trade negotiators are in Washington working with their American counterparts, but also part of a broader effort by the U.S. government to persuade U.S. companies and foreign governments allied to the United States and their national companies to avoid doing business with Huawei on the grounds that Huawei is essentially directed or controlled by the Chinese government, and that buying the sorts of computer equipment, the telecommunications equipment that Huawei manufactures, provides a significant security risk. As we move into this new technology called 5G, which makes possible all kinds of rapid, even more rapid communication and transmission of information, it also creates a significant possibility that the Chinese government will be able to track and infiltrate very sensitive Western government operations. And I'll note, to some extent, that effort by the United States is making success. We've seen moves by the Australians and the Canadians to not buy equipment from Huawei.
And many European countries are worried too. I mean, this is rippled across the world, I think.
Yes, actually the Czech National Tax Authority just announced this week that it will not buy equipment from Huawei for its network because of its concerns that it would enable the Chinese to essentially spy on Czech citizens, gather information, and even disrupt the functioning of the Czech government. So this is a very big contest going that has lots of moving parts, and it's generated lots of speculation about to what extent U.S. efforts are being coordinated. That is, did the Justice Department file this extradition request with Canada as a way of sort of putting pressure on the Chinese government, suggestions that the United States might trade essentially Ms. Meng for some concession on the trade front. Likewise, you've had Chinese officials and certainly officials in Huawei insist that they are not a front for the Chinese government. They're not spying, and pointing out with some justification that what they're being accused of is what the U.S. government, NSA, actively does itself. So there's a lot here, and they're pretty serious stakes because as we move further into a digital world, the ability of the devices that we use that when we go into this Internet of Things just creates massive amounts of data, creates massive amounts of opportunity for people to learn about the behavior of individuals, and also disrupt at a moment's notice day-to-day life.
You framed it really well, Jim. I think it really is show what's at stake. And I do think while there is a great deal of anticipation by a lot of countries, a lot at stake in this, there's concern about uncertainty in the way the U.S. is pursuing this alongside its trade talks that are going as we tape this podcast in Washington.
And I will note, you know, the hard thing for most people is to figure out what the actual merits are of these charges. I mean, on the face of it, I mean, there's a certain level of plausibility that the Chinese government could use its national champion Huawei and other Chinese firms as a stalking horse to be able to get information. But to the extent to which that is really the case, how it might differ from what U.S. intelligence agencies might do and the like, I think can get disputed, particularly when you're looking at friendly countries to the United States that are also friendly with the Chinese. How do you navigate this space? And particularly when everyone's looking around saying 5G is the future. You don't want to get left behind in the move to 5G because it's going to be the backbone of the modern economy. So awful lots of things going on there. Bob, let's switch gears and we'll do our figures of the week. As always, we will start with our audience figure of the week. I want to remind everybody that you can submit your figure of the week by tweeting us at CFR_org. Please use the hashtag TWNW. This week, we're going to go with an audience figure of the week that comes from our Twitter poll. The figure of the week is 5,000 troops to Colombia. Bob, why is 5,000 troops to Colombia the figure of the week?
Well, Jim, this refers to a yellow legal pad held by U.S. National Security Advisor John Bolton that had those very words on it. And there's a great deal of discussion about whether it was purposefully held up at a White House press conference so that all the press could see those numbers and thereby convey it to the world and to a Venezuelan audience, perhaps as well. Not clear. John Bolton basically just said administration policy remains, all options are on the table. Colombia actually ended up having to call a press conference, Colombian Foreign Ministry, and basically said it knew nothing about it, a U.S. troop deployment coming to the country. Others have noted, including our colleague Shannon O'Neill, that 5,000 U.S. troops in Colombia, whether or not it's a staging area for moving into Venezuela, doesn't accomplish much in a country the size and problems, the scope of Venezuela. This is a country that the U.S. has taken a great deal of steps towards pressing in the past week or so. It has recognized, as we've talked about on this podcast, Jim, it's recognized the presidency of Juan Guaido, who heads the opposition-led National Assembly. The U.S. then moved to ratchet up its toughest sanctions against the national oil giant and its U.S. subsidiary, Citgo. This one, as many experts have said, has real teeth and real potential to possibly force some government action, since it's the main cash flow source for the Venezuelan elites in a country that continues to implode and from which thousands of people per day are reportedly leaving. It all gets to what next in Venezuela? What are the off-ramps? And is U.S. military intervention a serious option at this point?
One thing I think is really worth stressing here, Bob, is that the Maduro government really wants to frame this as a standoff between Venezuela and the United States that obviously activates lots of historical memories about Yankee imperialism in Latin America. However, the United States is by no means the only country.
No, not at all.
That has recognized Mr. Guaido and calling on Mr. Maduro to step down. Indeed, most of the major countries of the Western Hemisphere joined with the United States. And my sense is, and perhaps I'm wrong on this, that there were a number of countries that gave Mr. Guaido the green light when he was going to invoke this provision of the Venezuelan Constitution that has allowed him to sort of self-declare as the new president. So this is not a simple Washington-Caracas standoff.
No, by no means. And by that, I think you're referring to certainly countries in the region, the OAS in particular, and countries from what's known as the Lima Group.
So yeah, but we have Canada, we have Brazil, we have Argentina. The one major country sitting on the sidelines in the hemisphere is Mexico. And that's because the new government of Mr. López Obrador is returned to a more traditional Mexican foreign policy of sort of strict non-interference in the affairs of others, which of course actually does interfere in the affairs of others. it allows Mr. Maduro to stay on.
And it's really focused attention on the powers propping up Mr. Maduro domestically, which would be the Venezuelan military, which is embedded in the regime at this point. It's a lot of its chief figures have positions of power or positions that derive some revenue, such as they are in the country right now. And so it's not clear to what extent there is a Venezuelan military that is willing to split away and pick a new winner. Whether or not, by the way, the new winner is a successor to Maduro from the existing elite, or whether it's somebody who's supported by the assembly or some sort of power sharing agreement. So, Jim, what about you? Who or what is your figure of the week?
Bob, my figure of the week is a number, and it's the number 12, as in 12 months this Sunday to the Iowa caucuses. I will note that we have five Democrats who have already thrown their hat in the ring. We have another three Democrats who've formed exploratory committees to decide whether or not they should run. We even had a candidate, former West Virginia State Senator Rich Ojeda, who has declared for the presidency and already ended his candidacy. But again, on February 3rd, 2020, Iowans will go out in what is almost certainly going to be a very cold night to cast their ballot for the next president. And not only are we a year away, I should also point out that this June will be the first of what is expected to be 12 Democratic primary debates. And if you're doing the math in your head, that's 4 months from now, you're going to get the first Democratic primary debate. And that's more than 16 months before Election Day. And if I can put that in perspective, John Kennedy declared his candidacy for the White House back in 1960, 10 months before Election Day. Bobby Kennedy did so 6 months before Election Day. And even Bill Clinton back in 1992 declared his candidacy only 13 months before Election Day. So when political scientists talk about the permanent campaign, they may be on to something.
Do we know anything, Jim, about outside of the Democratic sphere? Is there going to be a Republican primary, or is it too soon to be talking about something like that?
Well, we've certainly got a lot of talk about that in recent weeks in light of the government shutdown debacle. Everyone who reads public opinion polls knows that most Americans have blamed the president. A lot of speculation that's created an avenue for Republicans who are not crazy about President Trump to throw their hat in the ring. Obviously, if that happens, that's a major problem for the president. You talk to most political scientists, they will tell you that having a primary challenger is not good if you are an incumbent president. Presidents Ford, Carter, and the elder George Bush faced primary challenges and ended up losing their reelection bids. But again, at this point, there's a lot of speculation about whether somebody might throw their hat in the ring against President Trump. There's no signs yet that any Republican is seriously considering doing so.
And the elder Bush also faced a quite strong third-party challenge from Ross Perot. Any third-party challengers we should be watching yet, Jim? Too early.
Well, the founder of Starbucks, Howard Schultz, has been all over the media this week because he's considering running as a third-party candidate. Mr. Schultz, who for most of his life was a Democrat, says he's going to run as an independent because he believes the political system is broken and he's the man to fix it. And we'll see if this exploration turns into an actual candidacy. It's obvious that Mr. Schultz can finance a campaign if he wishes to do so. He's a billionaire, so we will see what happens. But what about you, Bob? Who or what is your figure of the week?
Jim, my figure of the week is a Virginia man named Stephen Pruitt. And Stephen Pruitt is reportedly responsible for shaping up to a third of all English language content on Wikipedia. Now, that is that has gotten quite a bit of attention in the past few days because of a CBS News report past weekend about Mr. Pruitt. He originally came to a bit of prominence back in 2017. Time magazine called him one of the 25 most influential people on the internet, and he hasn't slowed down quite a bit. I'll throw a few numbers at you just to give you a sense of what he's been up to. He has written something along the lines of 35,000 articles on Wikipedia over the past 13 years. He's made 3 million edits, and his span of topics goes from cultural to historical, and among other things, he has actually done quite a bit on writing and raising the prominence of biographies of women. He had learned that women were the subject of just 15% of biographical articles on Wikipedia. And so he began to set about fixing that imbalance, and he's written himself hundreds of articles about influential women. So that percentage now of women biographical articles has ticked up a few percentage points since he's gone at it. He does about 3 hours a day of work on Wikipedia. When he's not busy at his day job, he does about 3 hours of work a day, he estimates, on the website, which, by the way, is all done for free. And he does this separately from his regular day job, which is as a researcher in the Records and Information Governance Department of the U.S. Customs and Border Protection Agency in Washington. So somebody that, again, every now and then you hear about who are influential people, and this is sort of an uncommon one that I think came to a lot of people's attention, and I think shows the ability of individuals still to have quite a bit of influence on the internet as we know it today.
That sounds like a lot of commitment.
It is a lot of commitment, and I think it's one of the things that continues to drive Wikipedia, by all accounts, is the commitments of these types of editors, and it's going to be continuing to be interesting to watch how that site evolves.
It is an impressive resource, but for the reasons you just alluded to, it is a resource that it's worth double-checking elsewhere. Some of the stuff, really, really good. Other stuff, not so good.
Well, that's our look at the world next week and the internet as well. Here are some other stories to keep an eye on. Peace talks between the United States and Afghanistan continue. And Pro Football's Super Bowl is held in Atlanta.
Please subscribe to The World Next Week on Apple Podcasts or wherever you get your podcasts, and leave us a review while you're at it. They help us get noticed and improve the show. Please note that opinions expressed in The World Next Week are solely those of the hosts or our guests, not of CFR, which takes no institutional positions. Today's program was produced by Zoe Collis with senior producer Jeremy Sherlick. Special thanks go out to Kevin Lizarazzo, Corey Cooper, and Elizabeth Lordy for their assistance. This week, our recording engineers were Dan Mudd and Chris Vera. Thank you, Dan. Thank you, Chris. Our theme music is provided by Miguel Herrero and licensed under Creative Commons. This is Jim Lindsay saying, go Pats.
And this is Bob McMahon saying, go Rams.